I think I kind of want to start with a little orientation for our listeners. In talking about opiates, we're actually talking about lots of different drugs and products. You focus on two main opiate derivatives in this epidemic, one legal, one illegal. Can you just briefly describe which drugs are at play here?
Sure. Pharmaceutically speaking, the pharmaceutical industry has produced several. Most of them contain one of two derivatives of the opium poppy. One's called hydrocodone, which is a painkiller, and oxycodone, which is a painkiller. Those have been packaged into different branded drugs. Vicodin contains hydrocodone. Percocet contains oxycodone. And then there's others that go on from there, but those are pharmaceutically made drugs. Heroin is also a narcotic painkiller, devised as such. It's an illegal drug, largely because I think, well, there's a lot of history to it, but one reason would be that basically there is not really to heroin a lot of the great pain-killing effects that other drugs don't provide with somewhat less risk of addiction. I think heroin might be considered one of the most addictive of the opioids, but certainly they all are addictive. They all come from the opium poppy, and the opium poppy produces this opium goo that has been transformed by humankind into a narcotic painkiller as well as an addictive substance. For millennia, you know, it's the oldest product oldest plant that we transformed into a medicine that's still in use today.
Right.
So those are the two things. Now, in this country, heroin is not legal. The other opioids I mentioned are,
right,
for pharmaceutical use.
I want to talk a little bit about a big part of the setting for your book, and that's the town of Portsmouth, Ohio, right on the Ohio River, which is a central character in your narrative. It's the place where your tale begins and ends. How did you settle on Portsmouth as a way of telling the story of opiate addiction in America?
It didn't happen immediately. I really had planned to visit Portsmouth only twice. And the reason I would visit it at all was because it was essential to the story. It was the place where you begin to see the pill mill is invented. The pill mill is a pain clinic. As a revolution takes place in pain management in America, holding that we need to use these narcotic painkillers with far more aggressively, and doctors need to prescribe them far more often. Pain clinics begin sprouting up to deal with people's pain. In Portsmouth is where you see the first pain clinics sprout up that actually don't have really anything to do with treating people's pain, but really are just essentially facades for just giving people, or selling people rather, prescriptions for pills. And so there's no real pain work being done. There's no diagnosis, no MRIs, no real doctoring going on. It's really simply a front for just selling people prescriptions, and people come knowing that, and the appointments last a very short amount of time. Well, this thing was first established in Portsmouth. It spread from there. So the reason I went there in the first place at all was because I wanted to tell that part of the story. And then as I got there, I began to spend a whole lot more time than I planned there. And I began to realize that this was a town that had been savage, kind of ripped apart economically, job loss, demographically, half the population went away. It was a classic Rust Belt story. Main Street basically empties out. And then there was this swimming pool at the center of civic life in that town that was really a place where everyone knew each other, everyone saw each other, everyone kind of grew up at this swimming pool. It was really the town plaza in a sense, you know. And that swimming pool was also destroyed, dug up, and replaced by a strip mall. And it seemed to me then that as I got farther into this story that was really the story of the country, that we had done so much in this country to destroy community, what held community together, job loss, Main Street, population, but also these things, these facilities, these places where people would see each other, would spend time together, would get, you know, watch each other grow up, that we had destroyed that, either destroyed it or never invested in it in the first place. And so Portsmouth was, and Dreamland, which is why the name of the swimming pool was Dreamland.
Right.
I chose that as the title really because it was kind of a stand-in for all the things that we had done to destroy community in this country, and all the things that we had done to isolate ourselves. We had destroyed these facilities. We had not invested in public facilities, or we had destroyed them. And this was part of this kind of destruction of community that left us, therefore, very vulnerable to these drugs. These drugs were horribly destructive, and they came in and they thrived in areas where there was deep, profound, sad isolation. Could be in wealthy areas, too.
Right.
Could be in areas that didn't have much community feel at all, or newer suburbs and what have you. But it was also in these areas that had really been battered over the last 30, 40 years economically. And so that's really why Portsmouth was a stand-in, really, for the country. And Dreamland was a stand-in for all those things that we had done to ourselves to destroy a community in this country.
As you've described it, there are two sides to this coin. One is the pill mills that you found sort of got their start in Portsmouth, and where they were selling OxyContin and other things. OxyContin came on the scene in 1996. The other side of the coin in this book is black tar heroin from one small region in Mexico, and the network of people mostly from that area who spread it, beginning mostly in the western U.S. and then moved east. And one analogy you use in describing their operation was fascinating. You say that these heroin sales in Denver and Seattle and other places operated like delivering pizza. How so?
Basically, the system that these guys from this one little town figured out was a delivery system, very much like pizza delivery, where you were an addict, you would call a number, and this number would be a guy in an apartment somewhere. He would be ordering about a series of drivers. There'd be three or four drivers per crew, usually. These drivers would drive around town constantly all day long, 7 days a week, and their mouths full of little balloons of heroin. They'd have usually another larger stash hidden somewhere in the car. And the addict would call the number. The dispatcher would call the driver. The driver would tell the dispatcher would tell the driver where to meet the addict, and they arrange to meet each other and sell the dope that way. And these guys devised a system. Really, I think lots of people were doing it in Los Angeles eventually, but these guys were very aggressive. They were more expansionary than anybody else, and they began to take their system to other markets. One reason they began to do that was because they couldn't kill each other. They competed with each other. But they couldn't kill each other because they were all from the same town, unlike other parts of members of the underworld, where the way you deal with competition is you kill them, or you get them with them somehow like that. And these guys couldn't because they all knew each other. They're all related, or they were all knew where each other's mothers lived. So these guys had to find new markets. So once one market was saturated, they would have to then move on to find other markets, and this would. Usually it took them all across the western United States. But the real importance, I think, above all to this town and this system is that they were the first ones to figure out that there was an enormous new heroin market coming, bigger than anything they'd ever been able to discover in the western side of the United States, because they landed in Columbus, Ohio in 1998. And Columbus, Ohio was then pretty much like the ground zero for promotion of narcotic pain pills by pharmaceutical companies, doctors promoting very heavily to doctors that these were pills that they needed to use and needed to prescribe their patients, that they were now risk-free, no addiction for people who were suffering from pain. And the massive promotion of these pills and therefore the massive prescribing of these pills, huge new unprecedented amounts of these pills, and a lot of those pills ending up in the black market, began to create new heroin addicts, because people would switch from the pills, which were very expensive, to heroin. Well, these guys discovered that first, before anybody, and they discovered this. They saw what was that was going to happen. What's happening now? What happened began to happen in large numbers, really, in about 2010, 11, 12, 13, right in there. These guys were onto. They saw that market beginning to form in 1998, 99, when they arrived in Columbus, just as pharmaceutical companies, particularly Purdue Pharma, was very, very aggressively promoting these pills in that region, Ohio, West Virginia, Eastern Kentucky, places like that. And so that's also their importance, really. Maybe they're even more important reason for being in the book is that they were the first ones to see that market forming and then systematically begin to exploit it. And they, but they were doing it long, long ago. They were quite a ahead of the curve as far as that goes, which is another reason why I thought they were essential to the story.
And it's almost like the pharmaceutical companies sort of came up with the product or a new kind of product, and then the heroin dealers came in kind of with a knockoff, and it was cheaper, and in many ways it was more potent, right?
It's about as potent, or eventually got more potent. They stopped cutting it quite so much, and it's cheaper. And, of course, they provided something else that was essential for an addict, and that is a way of assuring that you will always get your dope every day. And exactly when you need it, because they have this very efficient delivery service. And so if you're an addict, one of the biggest problems you face is, where am I going to get my drugs every day? A lot of people had to go to very suspect motels or some skid row place,
right,
or a housing project or something. These guys said, no, we will bring it to you close to wherever you live. And so all of a sudden, it's an enormous convenience for addicts. They no longer have to go traipsing around the town looking for dope. They'll bring it to a gas station or the Target parking lot that's right around the corner from them or something like that. And that is another thing that these guys added: customer service, convenience, that nobody had really brought to many of these markets where they landed all across the country as they expanded.
It's hard to discuss the drug issue without discussing race, and you touch on some of that in your book, and how as middle-class white kids became the face of addiction to pills and then to heroin, late 90s and in the early 2000s, and lots of them died of overdoses, the public attitude toward drugs changed, including that of lots of politicians whose tough approach to crime began to change. Can you say a little bit more about that and compare it to, say, the crack epidemic of the 1980s?
Well, yes, there was a change. It took a long time to happen, though, because for many years, and this was a festering problem for 20 years, it didn't really get noticed initially, first of all, because I think it affected kids from Appalachia. And, that's a place where we're used to ignoring, frankly, as Americans. But then, as it affected more and more middle-class white folks, they tried very, very hard to keep it quiet. They didn't want people to know this. They didn't want to know that folks to know how that their children were addicted or died that way. And so it was hidden for a long time, largely by the will of the families who were involved in it, because they were so mortified. They were so ashamed. As years passed, though, particularly I would say in the last 2 or 3 years, you begin to see those families coming out of the shadows in a very big way. So you begin to see obituaries now telling the truth, not saying my son or boy died of a heart attack at home at 25, but rather, you know, due to the addiction, lost his fight with addiction, this kind of thing. You see these now fairly commonly, I would say. Began to see a whole lot more public talking about this and awareness on the part of this. And as part of that, a lot of these folks, I assume many of them, once having voted for politicians who were extraordinarily tough on crime, build more prisons, throw away the key, they began to change, because now it's their kids getting addicted. And they can see the utter damage, the horrible damage, lifelong damage that a felony record creates, for example. And so in time, their politicians begin to change in a lot of areas, very red areas, in fact. You really couldn't get elected anything as a Democrat, but you also, after a while, couldn't get elected as a Republican if you were not espousing some kind of compassionate approach to this problem. Yes, again, this was very different from the way we dealt with the crack problem, which was in the 1980s, primarily early 90s, building more prisons and throwing away the key, in a sense. I would say there's a big, big difference, though, in this problem as opposed to the crack epidemic. We did not focus on treatment back then. There was no focus on treatment. And there's a racial component to that. There's also, however, the big issue of violence. With the crack epidemic, it was the violence that was the problem more than almost the drug itself. It was neighborhoods besieged by drive-by shootings, by carjackings, by all kinds of problems that were very, very public in nature. Crack houses that would be a rental property would be taken over really quickly after the renter left and become almost a crack house. So you had this very public nature of violence to this whole problem. That was not seen during this problem with this epidemic. So during crack, really, I covered crack cocaine, pretty much the first job I had for 4 years. I was a crime reporter in a town that was overwhelmed by it. I don't remember anybody saying, gee, we need more treatment. Mm-hmm. I don't remember anybody in the Latino or Black communities, which were very large in that town, saying, gee, we need more treatment. There may have been a few, but really mostly it was get these guys off the streets, you know.
Right.
And I don't know if this problem would have, if the focus on treatment would be quite as strong, if this problem were accompanied by the same level of violence, public violence, that we saw during the crack years. I doubt it strongly, honestly, because back then you saw neighborhoods under siege. You just saw it almost impossible to live in some of these neighborhoods. And it was extraordinarily dangerous to be out in public. Particularly near an area where a crack gang might control the territory, because it wasn't just them, it was their rivals might roll up and shoot at them. And then if you were in the area, like a park, say, very difficult to go to that park, you know. So there are differences, and it's a complicated story. It's not so easy to – it's nuanced, let's put it that way.
Sam Quiñones is the author of Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Mr. Quiñones, 3 years on now after publication almost, this is a book that I should say, unfortunately, is still very relevant. Thanks very much for joining me to talk about it.
On the contrary, thanks, Bob, and I look forward to seeing you guys out there in Harrisonburg.